This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. We all love to malign the weatherman. But as we move into this year's hurricane season, it's worth taking a moment to appreciate the knowledge and the technology that enables forecasts not only for tomorrow and next week, but next month and even years to come. Later this hour, a local researcher explains how ocean salinity off our coasts can predict rainfall over the African Sahel. But we start today with hurricanes. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration is calling for an average season this year and say we may be moving out of a period of high-intensity hurricane activity that began in the early 90s. That's a relief, of course. On the other hand, climate change is amping up the chances of intense storms. We've always had hurricanes, and here on the coast, they're an expected, if not routine, part of life. But for inland New England, such storms are a rarity, and one storm holds a particular place in regional lore. The Hurricane of 1938 has been called New England's most damaging weather event ever. Stephen Long says to call it New England's Katrina would be an underestimate. His new book is 38, The Hurricane That Transformed New England, and it focuses not on damage to homes or coastlines, but rather forests. Stephen Long joins me now from a studio at Vermont Public Radio. Steve, welcome to Living Lab.
Thank you so much. Nice to be here.
Now, how powerful was the hurricane of 1938? I mean, if we compare it to things like Katrina or Irene or Sandy, really, how strong a storm was it?
Well, 38 was a Category 2 hurricane, and it brought 100-mile-an-hour winds all the way through New England up into New Hampshire and Vermont. The first time, only time, that Vermont has experienced a Category 2 hurricane. So it was unprecedented and totally unexpected. You were talking earlier about, in your intro, about the weather forecasting and the advances we've made. And we'll never, ever be surprised again by a hurricane like that. But in 1938, no one in central or northern New England had ever experienced a hurricane. Nobody thought that it was a possibility in New England. This was something that happened down in the Carolinas and Florida and the Gulf Coast. So when it arrived, it came totally, totally unexpected. And because of that, there was tremendous loss of life along the coast from the storm surge. But people did not get the word that this was coming along. And so it came at 50 miles an hour, basically started up the Connecticut River Valley and then ended up over the Green Mountains in Vermont, coming along at 50 miles an hour and totally unexpected, bringing 100-mile-an-hour winds, knocking down trees, knocking down barns, houses, trees over streets. It was a tremendous, tremendous storm. We experienced Irene in 2011. Irene was essentially a flood event. It was catastrophic flooding, but the 38 was every bit as much flooding plus 100-mile-an-hour winds.
Well, and actually, you write that
inspiring.
Yeah, you write that it actually, without the winds, would have been called the flood of 1938. That there was actually two storm systems on top of each other. There was already flooding going on across New England before the hurricane even hit. I mean, what was the confluence of events going on there?
Yeah, that's so interesting because it had been a wet summer and people were they had been inundated by rain that summer. And the week before the hurricane hit on September 21st. And in the week before it, there was 3, 4, 5, 6 inches of rain essentially throughout New England. So on the morning of the hurricane, I have in the book a fellow, Fred Hunt, who was 14 years old in Ringe, New Hampshire. He was out. He wanted to explore the flooding. He had never seen flooding like this.
This is an incredible story. And the fact that this 14-year-old wanted to go explore flooding, I just blew my mind to begin with.
So it was his idea of a lark. And so he went and he basically put on 15 or 20 miles that day, taking a look at the flooding. And he told me, he said, so as he was out, he could see the high water mark. And so it had receded. So he could see that the flooding was slowing down. It was receding. And then as he was out, before he got home, suddenly the trees started falling. And so the hurricane arrived in his area around 4 or 5 o'clock. And it was, as I say, totally, totally unexpected. And on top of just a flooding, an outrageous amount of rain in a totally, totally unrelated system.
And this storm took a really unusual track. I mean, we think of hurricanes kind of coming up and then starting to turn east, northeast. And instead, this just went straight north, right up the western boundary, essentially, of Connecticut, Massachusetts, Vermont, just kept going straight north. Do we know what the factors are that gave it the power to do that?
Yeah, it was a setup that happens rarely. Over the Atlantic, there is a sort of a semi-stationary high, a high-pressure system called the Bermuda High. And that's there year in, year out. And when hurricanes come, they just cannot move into a high-pressure system like that. They skirt it. And so the standard recurving that hurricanes often do, they come from Africa, and they come west and below the Bermuda High. And then they start to, once they get past it and before they reach the continent, they start to go northward. And then once they get past the northern extent of the Bermuda High, they turn east. So it's this clockwise motion around the Bermuda High. And in 1938, this high was stationed in a much more northern position than it normally is. And so the capacity for the storm to recurve there was no capacity. It had to go north. And it had steering currents associated with the low-pressure storm that had dumped all of the rain earlier. So that was steering it north. The steering currents around the Bermuda High were steering it north. It had nowhere to go except due north.
In case you're just joining us, my guest is Stephen Long. He's author of 38, The Hurricane That Transformed New England. We invite you to join our conversation as well. What stories of the hurricane of 38 did you grow up with? Call us toll-free at 866-999-4626 or send email to livinglabradio@capeandislands.org. Steve, I want to go back to Fred Hunt because you told the beginning of the story where this 14-year-old kid takes off to go, explore the flooding, but then gets trapped in this unexpected hurricane. So what happened to Fred Hunt?
So Fred, and at a certain point, he was a little bit worn out. His feet were blistered. He called his mom, as any 14-year-old would do, to come and get him. And so she comes and picks him up at the store, and they head home. But as they head home, there's a tree down across the road, and so they have to stop. And his mother goes up to visit the people in the house, and they see that there's just tremendous rain, and the rain's coming through their roof. And so she said to Fred, "You go home and be with your father. I'm going to stay here." And so he starts walking home, and he's going down one of these classic New England roads, tree-lined roads. It's got stone walls on either side. And at a certain point, he just sort of understood that there was that a tree had fallen behind him. He didn't hear it because the wind was roaring so loudly. But he saw that there was a tree behind, and the wind was just picking up crazy. And so it was a big pine tree. And so he decided that that might be the best place for him at this point. And so it was straddling the road and on top of a stone wall on the crown side of the tree. And so he just got in under that tree, and then the rest of the forest just blew down all around him. So this is 100-mile-an-hour winds knocking trees down everywhere, and he is just lying underneath that tree in his little refuge there. Mm-hmm. And so he's relished telling this story for his lifetime. And so I said, "Fred, God, you must have been scared." And he said, "Scared? Why would I be scared? I was safe. I was under that tree. And the trees, everything blew down. It took about 10 minutes. And after that, it was all done. What was there to be afraid of?"
a great story there, but really indicative of what was happening all over New England. I mean, the storm took
That's
down
right.
5 years worth of logging harvest in New Hampshire, Vermont, Massachusetts, Connecticut. Was it just the force of the winds, or were the forests for some reason particularly vulnerable? What happened?
Well, it's very interesting the patterns of damage. There's a number of reasons for why trees blew down and why they didn't. It was a huge amount of trees blew down, but it wasn't uniform. And so one of the big reasons that Massachusetts and New Hampshire were particularly vulnerable was that there was just a forest full of white pine. And there was white pine in these forests because of the land use history leading up to this point. So agriculture had essentially diminished in Massachusetts and New Hampshire post-Civil War. By 1880, there's very, very little agriculture in the two states. And so white pine is a tree that seeds in really beautifully on farmland that is no longer being cut for hay or no longer being pasture. And so these forests were full of white pine. And white pine is a particularly vulnerable tree to wind. It's shallow rooted, and it can grow very, very tall. And so it's just like a sail. And so all across Massachusetts and New Hampshire in particular, there were these sails ready to catch the wind. And then when 100-mile-an-hour wind came from the southeast, these trees just went. And it was tremendous damage. But as I say, it was not uniform. Where it happened, I mean, it was, you would see a half acre here, 2 acres there, 5 acres here. The largest was probably about 90 acres, but those were rare. It was more like a 2 acre patch was sort of the standard. And 600,000 acres were blown down in patches of 2 acres or so.
This part of New England had not been hit with a hurricane in over 100 years at this point. No subsequent storm has done this kind of damage. Is there any record of this kind of forest damage on this scale before the hurricane of 1938?
The only way to read that is by reading the soil, is by going into the soil and seeing where it's been churned up by trees uprooting. And so there is a history of hurricane damage to forests in New England. In Vermont, there's probably we really don't think that there was any more frequent disturbances of that nature than this one in 400 years. But the closer you get to the coast, the more common they are. And so there's this whole notion of a climax forest, and it's a very comforting notion of the archetypal deep woods. And these are We've all grown up with the notion of old growth in a climax forest. But in Massachusetts in particular, it's very, very hard to find any of that. And not just because there's been a lot of logging over the years, but because there's disturbance. There is a history of fire, and particularly there's a history of wind. And so the forests that greeted the settlers were not necessarily these big, huge stands of trees. They were forests that had been disturbed, and so some of them would have these huge trees, and others wouldn't. It's never been a uniform forest, and it never will be.
That's Stephen Long, author of 38, The Hurricane That Transformed New England. I'm Heather Goldstone. We appear to be having a problem with our phones at this point, so if you have stories of 38, send it to our email address, livinglabradio@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more when Living Lab continues after a short break. This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. The hurricane of 38 flattened some 600,000 acres of forest and caused both coastal and inland flooding across five states in New England. Stephen Long recounts the devastation of that storm and the lasting impacts for our region in his new book, 38, The Hurricane That Transformed New England. Do you remember 38, or did you grow up hearing about it? Share your memories and stories with us here at Living Lab. Our email address is livinglabradio@capeandislands.org. Stephen, the economic impact, not only of the home damage or factory damage along the coasts, but, you know, to the timber industry, to the maple syrup industry, when you take down all these trees, what did that do to New England's economy?
Well, so here we were at the end of the Great Depression. This was 1938, and people were struggling all over. And then you bring in this tremendous devastation. And this was in the time before people routinely had homeowners insurance. So all of this damage, not all of it, but much of it, was uninsured damage. So this is just one more kick in the teeth to people who had just been down and out, struggling with a really tough economy. And so you had mentioned earlier that it was 5 years, the annual harvest that was suddenly on the ground. And so so here's all of this debris on the ground, all of these trees. And it's a loss to all of these people who had owned these woodlots and owned them as their bank accounts. It's kind of a nice way to keep a bank account, to grow it in the woods, and you don't harvest it until the time is right. And suddenly all of this is on the ground. And so the New Deal, Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal, was very adept at moving quickly. And so they created a program called the Northeast Timber Salvage Administration. And it was able to get set up within basically about 6 weeks. And it started buying logs from people. And so it established a price, established guidelines, and set up something like 600 sites across New England, many of them ponds, but also dry sites, farmers' fields, that sort of thing. And so much of this wood ended up there. It was a tremendous, tremendous response that wouldn't have happened without the government stepping in. Because if market forces were left to be in place, then nobody would have gotten a nickel for this wood, because it was a tremendous glut.
All of this wood would have flooded the market.
Yeah, it was just there. And so what they did was establish a price, and they assumed that they would be holding on to this lumber for quite a long time, and that's why they were storing it in ponds, because it would keep in the ponds. It would not stain, and it would not get insect damaged. So there was that program. So in order to get the logs there and then to saw them, suddenly there was work for a lot of people. So anybody who could work could find work. plus the WPA, the Works Progress Administration, and the CCC, the Civilian Conservation Corps, they were brought in to help clean up the debris because they were very, very concerned about fire. So here you've got all of this white pine down on the ground, that all the tops, the needles, the twigs, people are just really, really concerned that this is going to be a second disaster on top of the first, that the whole thing's going to go up in flames. And so in the first 6 months after the hurricane, these government programs facilitated a huge, huge cleanup. And put all sorts of people to work. So this horrendous event, it had a good sort of back to work effect in that people who were willing and able to work could find work.
What about the ecological impacts of this? So I mean, you know, both of having the wood downed, having all of these trees died, but then of actually going through and cleaning them up and removing all of that wood from the forests.
Right. So this is a very interesting part of it. So you've got this catastrophe that is a catastrophe in human terms. But if you remove humans from the equation and you've got all of these trees on the ground, there's no problem there. It's just this is a natural disturbance. This is the way things happen. And if we were not here, if this happened 800 years ago, nobody would have known about it except the few Native Americans who lived in the area. And it might not have been that much of a problem because it was sporadic and they would have found other places. But when you introduce a large population into an area, suddenly this is a really big problem, and then in order to solve the problem, they did a huge cleanup. And so it's one way of looking at this event is that the worst weather event, the most destructive weather event that ever happened in New England, was followed by the biggest logging job. And so we cut and salvaged more than half of what went down. And so that was the equivalent of 3 years worth of harvest all on the ground, and that was salvaged all within a period of a year or two. So just a tremendous amount of logging. The logging at that point was much lighter on the ground than it has been in the recent past. Horses and oxen were used to skid the logs into a trail where they would be pulled by crawler tractors and scoots. So it was a lot of wood that was salvaged, but it was not there wasn't the erosion that you might expect from that level of harvesting. But another thing that happened because of it was the stream flow in rivers where all of this harvesting was done ran high for about 5 years afterward. And that's because there was not the forest in place to absorb all of that rain. And so the places where the trees were just left on the ground where it was not economically possible to salvage this, that there all the processes, the ecological processes, basically were still in place. Nothing was really disrupted. The crown was no longer 100 feet high. It was 10 feet high, so that all of the trees were horizontal rather than vertical. But that is not really a problem. It just creates the opportunity for a new forest.
Well, and Massachusetts has in recent decades actually been in a period of reforestation where we're actually gaining forest at this point. When you look at today's forests, are there still visible signs or things that you can point to in today's forest and say, that's because of 38?
Sure. So just physically, signs of the specific physical damage can be seen in what's called pit and mound topography. And that topography happens when a tree is blown down. When it blows down, the roots come up out of the ground, and they're So by coming out of the ground, it excavates a hole, so a pit, and then it deposits all of that adjacent to that pit. So it's basically transferring all of the material that clings to the root system to a place adjacent to it. And so you get this hummocky, hillocky kind of topography. And so you'll see and you can tell if it was from your garden variety wind or whether it was from the hurricane of 38 by the direction that the pits and mounds lie. And if they indicate that the wind came from the southeast, you can pretty much be guaranteed that that was hurricane damage. Because the southeast wind is rarely that strong that it will knock trees down. We're more accustomed to a westerly wind, the westerly airflow. So that's just the one thing that you'll see on the ground. But also the whole nature of the forest has changed because of it. That pine forest was temporary. That was a temporary placeholder. And so what came in, because pine does not succeed itself very easily unless it's a tremendous seed year. What comes in after a pine forest is blown down or logged off is the hardwoods. And the hardwoods have been sitting there in the understory biding their time. You may not even notice them. Thoreau wrote this great paper on the succession of forest trees, and he talked about how the oak seedlings are just sitting there waiting for the pine to go down. And so when the pine does go down, you have a new forest. And so this hardwood forest that covers much of Massachusetts now, much of it got its start from that hurricane and the salvage operation.
We are now in an era of rapid climate change, and storm experts would say the storms that maybe we expected once every 100 or 150 years, like the hurricane of 38, we can expect much more frequently. Given that, are there steps that you think we could or even should be taking to make our forests more storm resistant or more resilient in the face of increased storm activity?
I don't think that there's much anybody can do about protecting forests. And as I earlier, ecologically, it's not a disturbance of this nature is natural, and it's ugly. It's awesome. It's terrible to look at. If it's your own woods, it's a terrible thing to see. And you know, you'll be inclined to get some value out of it if you possibly can. But it's not in itself an ecological disaster. There's not much that we can do. I mean, we are when faced with something of this nature, we just have to accept our powerlessness. I suppose. Down on the coast, it's avoiding being close to the coast. It was a storm surge that did so much of the damage down in Connecticut and Rhode Island. It killed 400 people in Rhode Island. Houses were built too close to shore, and they were sucked out into the ocean. That's one thing that we can do, is to not build in vulnerable areas. As far as the forest goes, there's not a heck of a lot that we can do.
Hard lessons to learn from the hurricane of 38, and that's Stephen Long, author of 38, The Hurricane That Transformed New England. Steve, thank you.
Thank you so much, Heather.